In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about the future of the United Nations. Back in the fall of 2003, the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, appointed a panel to consider the possibility of reform and restructuring of the body. This panel released a report early in December. It is expected that the Secretary General will review it, perhaps make some changes, and then there will be general debate by other members probably coming up this fall. The panel has as its members a number of people, very high-level people in the world of diplomacy and politics, including the president of the Inter-American Development Bank, Brent Scowcroft, former National Security Advisor, the former Foreign Minister of Australia, the Secretary General of the Arab League, and the former UN High Commissioner for Refugees. The chairman of the panel is the former Prime Minister of Thailand. The panel itself is known as the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change, and has proposed some changes in the structure of the United Nations and of the Security Council. This morning, in this part of the program, we'll be talking about the panel and its work. And our guest for the show is Stephen Stedman. He is professor of political science at Stanford University, although right at the moment he is on leave from Stanford to act as the research director of the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have him as a guest. Among his interests are the subjects of civil wars, mediation, and conflict prevention. Before being at Stanford, he was associate professor of African studies at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. He has also served as consultant to the United Nations on a number of issues, including peacekeeping and civil war, light weapons proliferation, and conflict in Africa. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they're brief, and we ask that so that we get at as many different people as possible, and we can keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone who is interested in joining the conversation can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to use. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Stedman, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes,
we certainly appreciate
inviting
it.
Me.
It seems that while there's nothing new about criticisms of the United Nations, that at the moment we seem to be at a time where there has been quite a bit of criticism about the UN and also of the Secretary General, particularly in connection with the oil for food program, the Iraq oil for food program. And there are some people who see the United Nations as being at a very critical point right now. In fact, there were some stories last week that in early December, a secret meeting, no longer secret, I guess, had taken place at the apartment of former UN Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, involving the Secretary General, and a group of people who considered themselves and would be considered to be both his friends and friends of the UN. And apparently they sat down with Mr. Annan and gave him some very strongly worded advice about what he should do, what he should be doing with the leadership of the UN and so forth. Is there a crisis now? Is the United Nations at a point of crisis?
I think that the United Nations is at a time of crisis. This was recognized by the Secretary General when he established the high-level panel. This all goes back to a speech that he gave to the General Assembly in September of 2003. And he said, look, this organization has hit a fork in the road. And if we do not make it more effective at addressing the threats of today, it's going to be irrelevant. It's going to be irrelevant in the face of unilateralism, as member states simply decide that they're better off going it alone. So I would say, yes, it is at a point of crisis. And part of our job on the panel was to really assess, you know, what are the things that the UN does well and what does it do poorly? And is it possible? And if so, how do you make it more effective for the 21st century?
Well, let me follow up on that response and perhaps give you the opportunity to talk a little bit here for a moment about the things that the United Nations does well and the things the United Nations does poorly.
Okay. First of all, what does it do well? We found that in a number of areas, the United Nations performs a lot better than it is given credit for. Let me just give you a couple examples. If you take something like peacekeeping in civil wars, now, peacekeeping in civil wars has become the operational face of the United Nations in peace and security. When people think of the UN, they tend to think of Blue Helmet peacekeeping operations. Now, there have been horrendous failures in peacekeeping, the most notable being Rwanda in 1994, where the United Nations Security Council did nothing in the face of a genocide. As well, you have Srebrenica, where genocide took place, again, with inaction from the United Nations Security Council. But if you look at peacekeeping as a whole in civil wars, you find two interesting facts. The first one is that since 1992, the number of civil wars in the world has decreased by about 40%, which means all of this activity of prevention, mediation, peacekeeping, peace building is having an aggregate effect in drawing down the numbers of civil wars. Secondly, there have been more negotiated settlements of civil wars in the 1990s than in the previous 200 years. In the 1980s, even as late as the 1980s, it was assumed you cannot negotiate a civil war. Either one side had to eliminate the other, or you had to have unconditional surrender, as in our civil war. But the international community has shown in the 1990s that you can actually mediate an end to these wars and save hundreds of thousands of lives. And the United Nations has been central in almost all of those successes, like El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Namibia, Cambodia, Mozambique. So that's what I say about having a balanced assessment, is that you have to note the failures, and the failures were awful, but you also have to recognize the value in what it does right. Something like proliferation, if you go back to the early 1960s, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, if you go back to the 1960s, the Kennedy administration had estimated that within 15 years you would see 25 nuclear weapon states. Well, 40 years later, there are 8 or 9 nuclear weapon states, and part of the reason why there are so few has been the success of the non-proliferation treaty and the role of the International Atomic Energy Agency in moderating the demand for these weapons and regulating the supply of materials for these weapons. So over a course of 40 years, it's been successful. What the report also points out, however, is because of changes in technology and also changes in politics, the rise of non-state actors, this is a regime and a treaty that's in very deep trouble and needs to be completely overhauled. But it doesn't negate the fact you had 40 years of relative success. When you turn to areas of biological security, the World Health Organization was absolutely crucial in stemming the spread of SARS. It was absolutely essential in the eradication of smallpox. It has almost eradicated polio. These are major achievements, and these are the kinds of achievements that you only get because you have institutionalized, sustained multilateral efforts that address these problems. So again, that's on the success side. On the failure side, the United Nations, like the world community at large, was woefully and shamefully late in responding to AIDS. It's still shamelessly under-resourced, the battle against AIDS. Similarly, as I already mentioned, probably the greatest failure of the United Nations has been in addressing genocide and large-scale ethnic cleansing. And we point out, again, that this failure continues as we look at the slow response to Darfur and in Sudan. The Security Council itself is much better at passing resolutions that say you must do something and then not enforcing those resolutions. Sanctions are often applied symbolically as opposed for real results. Our report has been lauded as being hard-hitting, but what I think I'm proudest about is that it really is a balanced assessment. If everything was all bad, you would say, why do we have this organization? But in fact, it has been effective in some areas, and you want to build on that effectiveness. Mm-hmm.
I was struck by taking a look at some of the remarks, some of the comments that the Secretary General made about the recommendations of the panel. For example, that he said he appreciated and he supported the emphasis on the idea that development is very important to establish and to solidify collective security. He also noted that he was pleased that the panel called for a major initiative to rebuild global public health, and there are other things. Now, the thing about the United Nations is that this organization is only as strong as the commitment to it by its member nations, and not only a kind of a moral commitment, but a direct financial commitment. These kinds of things we're talking about, development, public health, others, they're going to require resources. And I wonder whether you think that there is the commitment out there among the member nations, that is those nations that really have the resources, to commit them to the organization.
Well, I think that we obviously think yes. And we made our case primarily on self-interest. That is that we describe a collective security system, a new collective security system, where everyone's threats are addressed on an equitable basis. And we give three reasons why we believe now, for instance, the developed countries must take poverty and development seriously, for three reasons. One is interconnections amongst threats are unprecedented. Secondly, that mutual vulnerability between rich and poor, weak and strong, is at an all-time high. And the third, that no power, no matter how great, no matter how strong, can unilaterally defend itself against the range of threats that we face today. And what our report says is we have to get away from thinking of collective security as simply security against aggression by states, to really look at the broad, diverse threats that we truly face today, which are economic and social threats like poverty, AIDS, environmental degradation, civil wars, genocide and ethnic cleansing, weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, chemical weapons, terrorism, and transnational organized crime. And the goal is to build a system in which, wherever you are in the world, you see that your threat is being addressed in a robust manner. And again, we make our case primarily on self-interest. It's easy to make the case on for moral reasons, why we're all in this together. But we say, no, things are different today, and a threat to one is truly a threat to all.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, and also perhaps I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Stephen Steadman. He's professor of political science at Stanford University, and right at the moment he is on leave from his position at Stanford and is serving as research director of the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change. And this is a panel of rather prestigious individuals drawn from around the world, people involved in diplomacy and involved in government, that was appointed by Kofi Annan in the fall of 2003 to look at the question of restructuring, potential restructuring and reform of the United Nations. They released a report early last month, in early December, and there's no doubt going to be a lot of discussion about it in the United Nations over the next year or so, or at least in the next few months. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Indiana, and we'll talk with them on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. In the last few minutes, you've repeatedly used the case that the Security Council did not do anything. And I wonder if you could tease that apart, which countries are, stopping things. I would presume the United States is one of them. And I wonder if you could bring up something I've never heard the answer to, but I know some time ago we refused to pay our dues. I wonder if we have done that, or are we just sort of slowly moving a little bit of money at the time? And in terms of the Security Council itself, has there ever been any move to bring in other countries other than, the G8 or the G7 or whatever you want to call them? That would be a nice moral move, I would think. And also, we're dealing with the Bush administration, and I just wondered if you could give some views on what they're doing to help and hinder what you would like to have done to get things straightened out, in a sense. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's maybe it would make sense here to deal with some of the points the caller made about the Security Council, because the panel has indeed made a couple of recommendations about expanding the membership of the Security Council. And this, I think, among the panel put out a long report. It's more than 100 pages long, and there it deals with a lot of areas. But it seems to me, in what I've read about it, the aspect that got the most attention was indeed this proposal, or were these proposals to add members to the Security Council. So why don't you talk about that?
Okay. Let me answer the first question of the caller.
Sure.
In terms of the failures, who is responsible on the Security Council? And I wish that it was as simple as saying, oh, there's always one or two usual suspects. But in the cases that I point to, in fact, there are different actors who were responsible at the time for inaction. I think if you go back to Rwanda in 1994, it is very clear that the United States was the dominant actor in making the United Nations peacekeepers be withdrawn and drawn down and refusing to countenance any kind of robust action. Now, 10 years later, in the case of Darfur in Sudan, the United States has actually taken a lead in trying to get more robust action, but you find that it's China and, in this case, Pakistan, which are very anti-interventionist, really being the key actors in trying to slow down any kind of intrusive solution to actually protecting people on the ground. So it varies. On the question of expansion of the Security Council, our panel said that they endorsed the idea of expanding membership. Right now you have a 15-member Security Council, five of whom are permanent members. They were made permanent members back in 1945. That's France, Great Britain, the United States, China, and the Russian Federation. And obviously things change over 60 years, and yet because they're permanent members, they're in essence kind of an aristocracy. But it was done for very good reasons, which is that you want the most powerful nations assured that they are going to be involved in the decision-making and that nothing is going to happen that's going to imperil their own national interests. Well, it's a very different world 60 years after the founding of the United Nations, and the feeling is that the body is not representative, certainly not representative of the developing world. It's also not representative in the sense that several actors who contribute tremendously financially to the organization are not permanent members of the Security Council. And those are Japan and Germany. There's a sense that regional powers such as Brazil and India should get greater participation in the Security Council. So we said, well, okay, for reasons of representation and for reasons of getting those countries that truly contribute more to the organization a greater say in how the organization is run, you need to expand the Security Council. The problem was that the panel couldn't agree on how you do that. There were some panelists who believed that the way to do that is not only expand the number from 15 to 24, but rather you should also increase the number of permanent members from 5 to 8, 9, 10, 11, right? And then there were others who felt that the whole idea of permanent members was kind of anachronistic, and that to better suit a flexible, dynamic, democratic world where you want more accountability, what you need are longer terms. Right now, terms on the Security Council for everyone else are 2 years, and the panel said, let's have 4-year terms that are renewable. Right now, if a country other than the permanent five is on the Security Council, they're only on for 2 years, and then they have to step down for 2 years before they can run again. So we said, well, let's get rid of that and say we're going to have these longer-term seats that are renewable, subject to election in the General Assembly. And this will give the powers like a Brazil or an India or a Japan or a Germany, in essence, another way of being longer-term members with more influence on the decision-making. So, yes, this was an integral part of our report. It's gotten a lot of attention. All I would say on that is that I think Security Council reform is 10 paragraphs out of 300. So, in my mind, it's probably gotten a disproportionate amount of attention, but it has gotten a lot of attention.
Well, given that fact and given that I would expect that there would be a lot of interest in this particular subject. Let me ask you this. who makes this decision? Is this a matter of the entire membership deciding? Is it a member of these members of the Security Council deciding?
If this involves any reform that involves rewriting of the United Nations Charter, it requires a vote of two-thirds of the members of the General Assembly. So two-thirds of the 191 member states in the world would have to vote for a particular reform. And then it has to be ratified by two-thirds of the membership, including concurrent ratification by the permanent five, France, UK, Russia, China, and the United States.
And would they, those permanent members who have the veto power on the Security Council, would they have the power to veto the proposal if they didn't like it?
They would have the power to veto by not ratifying the change.
This gets at one issue that I know that some people have pointed to that was not, I imagine perhaps it was discussed, but it's not among one of the recommendations that has to do with the way the Security Council operates, and that is the idea that perhaps one might modify, perhaps too radical to think about, but one might even get rid of the veto power that the permanent members have. Some people argue that that fundamentally makes this a fundamentally undemocratic institution where you have any one of the permanent members. Everybody else can vote for something, but any one of the permanent members, if they don't like it, can veto it and thereby subvert the will of the majority.
Right. The panel did not call for the abolition of the veto, I think, for two reasons. I mean, one is that there were several panelists who still believe that it has a purpose, essentially by reassuring the United States that the body is not going to act against its interests. And this leads to the second reason why many of the panelists felt that you shouldn't change the veto, which is that they're basically pragmatic. And they knew that a UN report that called for the abolition of the veto would sink like a stone in Washington, D.C., and Congress would have none of it. And it wouldn't get serious attention to all of the other issues that are really compelling today. As I said, you know, Security Council reform is about 10 paragraphs out of 300 paragraphs. There are a lot of problems that need action, and we want results. And I think that if the panel had gone out on a limb and simply said, oh, we'll get rid of the veto, it probably would have been dismissed out of hand. Hmm.
Well, we're at our midpoint already, and again, I would like to introduce our guest, and we'll go to another caller here in just a moment. We're talking about some of the recommendations made by a panel known as the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change. This was appointed by the Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, in the fall of 2003 to look at the issue of reform restructuring of the United Nations. The panel released a report, a long report with many recommendations, in early December. And we're talking about it this morning with Stephen Stedman. He's a professor of political science at Stanford, but right at the moment he is on leave and he is serving as the research director for the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change. He's also served as consultant to the UN on a number of issues, including peacekeeping and civil war, the proliferation of light weapons and conflict in Africa, and also preventive diplomacy. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number, if you'd like to join the conversation. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller to bring in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Yes, I have read your report, and in fact, I've taught courses on the United Nations, both at Harvard and here at the University of Illinois. From my perspective, the main threat to the United Nations is the international legal nihilism of the Bush Jr. administration and its lieutenant, Tony Blair. These are two rogue states that are severely undermining the integrity and continued existence of the United Nations organization across the board. And if the United Nations organization across the board cannot deal with this legal nihilism by Bush Jr. and Tony Blair, it is going to go the exact same way the League of Nations did when it failed to deal with the international legal nihilism of Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin.
Well, that also gets at the caller, one of the questions that the first caller asked. You want to respond to that, Professor Stedman?
Well, sure. If you go back to the speech of Kofi Annan in, to the General Assembly in September of 2003, when he mentioned that he was going to establish this panel, he put the problem somewhat differently, which is, he said, look, the lack of an effective multilateral institutions is a threat to all of us. In some ways, it's a threat precisely because powerful countries, if they feel that multilateral institutions are ineffective, are going to go their own way, and that there are going to be costs and fears that are going to be raised because of that. You know, what the panel has sought to do is to put forward ideas which could be the basis for Washington, D.C., and the Bush administration, and certainly the Blair administration, to engage them, to convince them that, in fact, having strong multilateral institutions will make them more secure. That's the challenge, and we'll wait and see to see if we've been persuasive. I will point out, however, that there's some interesting aspects of how the Bush administration has treated the United Nations. I mean, I think rhetorically, there are many within the administration who have been dismissive of the United Nations. On the other hand, it did spend 6 months trying to get a resolution that would authorize the war in Iraq. Right at the same time in February of 2003, at the same time that the Bush administration was castigating Germany and France and Russia for stymieing action in Iraq, Colin Powell said, maybe we should take North Korea to the Security Council. Well, that was interesting. For the last 6 months, the Bush administration has been pushing to take Iran and the whole issue of Iran and possible proliferation to the Security Council. And, of course, it quickly found out in Iraq that the United Nations was absolutely essential if it is going to create any kind of strategy for being able to leave this country, being able to leave Iraq. And, of course, the United Nations has been there, was essential in helping to create the present interim government, and also is on the ground working for the elections. So you have the rhetoric from the Bush administration. But on the other hand, if you just look at behavior, you find that the United Nations actually has been helpful to this administration.
Let's go and talk with someone else. This is a caller in Indiana, a listener in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I'll be honest with you. I just happened to catch this channel on the radio. It scares the death out of me that we got people who teach like they do and have this kind of view. Being an American and being a superpower is not a bad thing. And if it wasn't for the U.S., there wouldn't be a U.N. And it seems like all this is just anti-American. I mean, it makes no sense. We have to protect ourselves. And being a one world with a government with something like the UN who can money off, such as they did with the oil, the food for food programs and the other things they've ripped off money and not been accountable for, and you still want us to trust it. Well, it's scary knowing educators have this view and they overlook all these problems the UN does have, and it has nothing to do with what we did or the way we feel about them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would suggest that the caller should read the report because, as I said, this is a fairly hard-hitting report, and we didn't pull any punches when it came to what the United Nations has failed to do and has been flawed at doing. But what we also do is point out that there are a number of things that the UN does well and can do better. But I just want to say I actually agree with the caller's point that the United States is absolutely essential for the United Nations to work at all. You know, the United Nations was a creation of the United States. This was President Roosevelt's dream, and it was President Truman who carried through with that dream. And when you see the United Nations working well, it's because the United States invests time, resources, energy, attention to make it work well. And all our panel says, quite frankly, is, look, it is up to the United Nations, and you, the member states, to convince the United States that you can be more effective, because if you can make that case, then you will be more effective.
All right, let's go on. We have another caller in back here locally in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I thought that last caller was a little scary to me, because apparently that caller... is so unaware of or has so little concern for the ability of the rest of the world to live its life and national interests without being bullied by us, that he doesn't seem to see the consequences of that and the way that kind of thinking has led to American soldiers being killed in Iraq and in Afghanistan and all the attacks against us all over the world, and Osama bin Laden being made an icon for the rest of the world, and he's getting more and more support in the rest of the world on a monthly basis. You know, he sees, apparently he's a Bush supporter, and I want to quote article I read that to me really brings to head the idea that you can't just be looking for what you keep saying effectiveness in the UN, because the way we see effectiveness is apparently caving into anything we want. This one sentence is, quote, in giving life to Bush's doctrine of preemptive war, the assault on Iraq represents the first time a U.S. president has claimed, even boasted, that he had the right to launch such a unilateral attack against a country that had not attacked the U.S. and did not pose any imminent threat, and that international authority was unnecessary, unquote. So that kind of attitude, I don't see how, with that kind of attitude, we have the rest of the world should you keep saying we're necessary to the process. I think a lot of people are beginning to think what's necessary is to get us out of the process, and I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you want to comment on that, Professor Stedman?
Sure. What we say in the panel is that I want to go to a general point here, which is the nature of today's world and the nature of the threats that we face. And it actually goes to the previous caller and also the rebuttal by this caller. If the United States is threatened by nuclear terrorism, that is, the prospect that in the future non-state actors are going to get their hands on, let's say, highly enriched uranium and create a improvised nuclear device. If that is truly a threat to the United States, and our panel says it is, how do you defend against that? The amount of highly enriched uranium you would need to create an improvised device could fit into 6-gallon milk jugs. That's all you would need. Now, we know how much, illicit material, drugs, et cetera, are smuggled into the United States every day. So if terrorists were ever to get their hands on that much fissile material, they're not going to have any problems getting it here to create a bomb. So then the question is, then you have to start asking some bigger questions. Okay, well, now if that's truly a threat to the United States, how do you really counter it? What is going to be an effective strategy for countering it? And you quickly realize, well, first of all, you've got to clean up all of the fissile material in the world, right? You've got to get serious about getting rid of all the highly enriched uranium that's lying around. Secondly, you want to get international, and you're going to need international cooperation to do that. You're going to need international cooperation to stop the production of highly enriched uranium, right? You're going to need countries like Brazil, India, et cetera, to all agree on something like this. Third, you're going to have to get cooperation in terms of intelligence. You're going to have to get cooperation in terms of countries being willing to interdict shipping at sea of any sort of suspicious materials. You're going to have to create state capacity throughout the world because borders are so porous. And all of a sudden you quickly, and that doesn't even get you to the issue of, you know, what do you have to do to limit the environment in which terrorists thrive, right? So when you start to think about a comprehensive strategy for really defending yourself, it points to international cooperation, international cooperation, international cooperation, international cooperation, international cooperation. That's how you're going to make yourself more secure. Now, you turn it around. Because in our report is not just about making the United Nations effective for the United States. It is about making it truly effective and equitable for all. And as we say throughout the report, you know, if you're truly going to have a collective security system for the 21st century, it has to be as robust in its response to poverty and HIV/AIDS as it is to terrorism, right? Because if it's not, why should 170 countries in the world who don't think that terrorism, and especially terrorism with weapons of mass destruction, is a compelling threat to them, why should they cooperate to help the United States in securing itself? So we look at this as a problem of, first of all, equity. You have to address everyone's threats, and you have to be robust in addressing everyone's threats. And the reason that other countries should be engaged in trying to make the United States safer is that they should expect some cooperation from the United States in making them safer. And if you don't get that, this isn't going to work, quite frankly. And this thing will collapse, and it will be irrelevant. But it will be irrelevant during a time when you desperately need sustained international institutionalized cooperation to address all of the compelling threats of the day. That's where we're at.
We are now into our last 15 minutes in this first hour of Focus 580. And again, I want to introduce our guest for this hour. Stephen Steadman is professor of political science at Stanford University. Among his interests, the subject of civil wars, conflict prevention, peacekeeping. He currently is on leave from Stanford and is serving as a research director of the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change, this advisory committee that was appointed by the Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, to look at the issue of reform, restructuring of the United Nations. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to Champaign County and line two. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, the adjective effective actually rankled me, too, and I think maybe if you tie those two, equitable and effective, it has a nice ring to it, and it might be it's actually much more appropriate because the history of the UN is really shocking if one examines it. The way it's characterized here as lame talking shop, etc. The U.S. has used the veto more than any other country in the world multiple times, and effective veto in other circumstances where it actually doesn't need a Security Council veto, and it has misshapen, you know, getting rid of all sorts of agencies inside of the U.N. that were doing great work, but did not. You know, a lot of this was done during the Reagan era. I recommend Phyllis Bennis's good work on the history, more recent history of the UN. We are very much misled, it seems to me, about it. One thing that just in the caller who was so uncritical of the Bush administration and critical of the UN, this idea that the Security Council and Annan were responsible for the oil for food abuses. The U.S. was the biggest importer of illicit and licit transacted oil from Iraq before. So, you know, the money, just follow the money. I mean, it's ridiculous to point that at Annan. Everybody knew what was going on, and the other money the oil that wasn't coming here was bolstering up Turkey, whom we were trying to make act in a certain way. So it's just, and just to keep the economy floating too. So this oil for food business doesn't stand up to more than a moment's analysis if you really look at it. I guess that's not a question, but I'll let someone else have a chance. Thanks.
All right. Well, I don't know if you wanted. This is something that there is an inquiry involving Paul Volcker. Sometime soon there's going to be a report, and it is also something that people in this country, particularly people on the right, conservatives, have been talking about for quite a long time. Is this a potential problem either for the UN collectively or for the Secretary General?
Well, I want to say one thing just to add to the debate, and that is there's this tendency in America to somehow believe that the Security Council is something that is apart from the United States, when in fact the United States is the single most powerful member of the Security Council. When the Security Council acts or doesn't act, it's not as if it is acting in a vacuum where the United States hasn't influenced it. The United States is part and parcel of the Security Council in making decisions. And I raise this because now, our panel didn't go into oil for food, and I can talk about that, why we didn't, precisely because there was an ongoing independent investigation by Volcker into the matter, and we didn't feel that we had the information to go into it. But what we do know is that the primary responsibility for the contracts on oil for food and oversight was the Security Council, and that it was the United States. So if there is a scandal there, a big reason for why there was a scandal there is that the Security Council, of which the United States was one of the most, certainly is the most powerful member, was asleep at the wheel. And it's conveniently ignored by many of the right-wing critics of the United Nations. Now, in terms of oil for food, as I said, we felt there's an independent investigation going on. We don't know what the facts are. They have access to it, and so, you know, on a general principle, obviously, any sanctions regime that is in place by the Security Council, you need to have good accounting and a good accountability, both from the Security Council and the Secretary, and we said that. But I would encourage readers to look at there was an interview today in the New York Times with Paul Volcker, where he says, well, first of all, the sums that what they've uncovered so far in all of their investigations are that the sums have been greatly, by almost a 20-fold, overestimated by members of Congress. And that some of the figures that Congress has used of $20 billion, $25 billion. And he said, no, what we found is about what the American investigators showed about 6 months ago. We're talking about $1.7 billion that were involved in the oil for food and billions of dollars that actually went into smuggling. And here the caller is right, that the Security Council sort of cast basically refused to act, had a lot of information about illegal smuggling of oil into the neighbors of Iraq, and the United States decided this is not something we want to take action on. So in the end, I think when all the facts are out, people are going to have a much greater understanding of, you know, who is truly culpable in this situation, whether it was member states or the Secretariat.
All right.
Meaning the Secretary General and his permanent employees.
We'll continue. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign, line three.
Yes. I'd like to shift to the UN itself and talk about the fact that it seems like there's many institutions which are so-called UN institutions which are themselves the very problem. It's not the world. It's not, for instance, the Human Rights Commission of the UN, which is in Geneva, which has some of the most egregious human rights violators as its members. I know your report touches on this, and maybe you could talk about this more. Sudan is one of the members, I believe, or was. Also, the general UN bureaucracy of the assistant and associate and undersecretaries, et cetera, who from time to time various scandals come out about them but seem to be covered up, whether it's in terms of their public pronouncements reflecting not UN policy but their own personal and their nation's political priorities. So I'd like you to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. We did talk about in our report both about the problems with the Human Rights Commission and also what we thought of as problems within the bureaucracy here. The fact that the sort of a logic of there's a political logic in many of the appointments that are made to spots in the UN, and of course that comes from the member states themselves putting pressure on the Secretary General to make some appointments. And clearly, oftentimes the best people are not being appointed or promoted, and we say that. And we say, look, you got to get serious about this. The Human Rights Commission, what the panel said was the Human Rights Commission, now the Human Rights Commission is member states. It's a small group, about a fourth of the membership of the United Nations, who run every couple years to be on this commission. So these are member states. And what we say is that it's not doing its job. Its job should be to promote and protect individual human rights in the world. And instead, what it has become is a forum for states to either try to defend or silence critics, defend their human rights records or silence critics of their human rights records, or it's a forum for those who simply want to get on so they can cast aspersions on other states' human rights records. And what gets lost in the shuffle is, you know, are you making a difference on the ground and actually protecting individual human rights? Now, there are a couple ways of trying to reform that body, and I'll be frank. We on the panel research team tried to put forward ideas, for instance, about, well, there should be criteria for membership, right? You should only have only those countries that perform well and sign international treaties and comply with international treaties on human rights should be eligible to run for the Human Rights Commission. And we could not get the panel to sign off on this. I mean, again, this is a diverse panel, 16 leaders from all around the world, and we just couldn't get them to agree on a consensus on this. What the panel said instead was that everything that we've diagnosed is a problem. Now, what we have to do is, one way of getting out of the politics of all this is to make it a universal body and just say, all 191 members now are on the Human Rights Commission, because that reminds everyone, every state, that they are that they have commitments to universal human rights. But the only way that you could do that is if you create an advisory panel with real expertise, with real human rights experts, people who are experienced in dealing with human rights, who are professionals, and they're objective. And that's who would do the work. So you create an advisory panel of 15 members appointed by the Secretary General and the High Commissioner, and they would actually do the day-to-day work and drive what the commission does. And then the commission just exists as it does now, in essence, anyway, as a debating society. That's what the panel put forward. I don't think it's an ideal solution, and there were others that I would have preferred, but that's where the panel came out.
Will that get at your question, caller?
Yeah, let me just take one more step, and then I'll leave it. Maybe the problem itself is the idea that there can be such a thing as so-called a world democracy, because essentially what you have is not people, but you have governments who have political positions, and yet they all so-called vote to make decisions. But this isn't really an issue of democracy. What it is, it's alliances of various sorts that come together to exclude or include, to criticize or take positions. So the idea that the UN should be democratic is really nonsense in terms of the words of democratic. And we really, well, what we need to do is recognize the realpolitik of the UN. So I'll just throw that out and hear your response.
We're getting kind of short on time, but whatever you, however you'd like to respond there, Professor Stedman.
It is a body that has a very weird take on what constitutes democracy. I mean, they define democracy as being based on, you know, one country, one vote, which gives you some perverse results. I mean, in anything that takes two-thirds of a vote, you can get one-third of the countries to vote against and block something that constitute about 4% of the world's population. So that, you know, a country with 100,000 people counts as much as a country with 1.3 billion people. So it is strange in that regard. What we say in the report is that all reform of the United Nations has to take into account the realities of power, but they cannot ignore principle. If everything is all principle and ignores the realities of power, this will be a toothless organization. If it is all power and doesn't recognize principle, then it's a feckless organization. And in our report, we've tried to, in essence, wed and marry power to principle to make it more effective.
We had someone call in, by the way, and I do want to mention this, wanting to know whether there was a website where people can read the report that we have talked about, and the answer to the question is yes. Yes, there is. If you have internet access and you go to www.un.org/secureworld, that's as one word, you can see it. And that's the report is titled A More Secure World. So again, www.un.org/secureworld. And I think at that, we're going to have to leave it. Perhaps on another day we can talk some more. But for the moment, we have to thank our guest, Stephen Stedman. He's professor of political science at Stanford, and at the moment is serving as the research director for the high-level panel on threats, challenges, and change, that panel that produced the report that we have been talking about. Professor Stedman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.